In case you haven't heard, it's officially an Abercrombie summer. The A&F Vacation Shop has everything on your packing mood board. I desperately need their new one piece, the A&F Marina. It's strapless, so flattering, and paired with denim shorts will be my go-to beach outfit this summer. Finally, your suitcase isn't complete without finding that dress. You know, the one for the photo shoot. Abercrombie's boho dresses have that perfect beachy romantic look. Make it an Abercrombie summer. Shop their newest arrivals in-store, online, and in the app.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Tech Entrepreneur on a Mission podcast. My name is Ton Dobbe and I'm the founder of Value Inspiration and the author of The Remarkable Effect. I envision a world where every B2B SaaS startup succeeds because they're creating software that customers would miss if they were gone. And here's why. Research consistently shows that 90% of all startups fail, and that's bad. What's worse, however, is that 75% of SaaS scale-ups fail. Companies that are supposed to have product market fit. Far too few scale-ups create the traction they aspire for and fail for the wrong reasons. And I believe this should stop. And hence I created my business. And the goal that I have with this podcast is twofold. First, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential that we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. Secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what it requires to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. The guest of the podcast this week is Thomas Wulff Wilhelmsen, co-founder and CEO of Less.
I think for us, we've been focusing more on the persona than on the sector or industry. We call them doers, people that are sort of curious by nature, that are frustrated with being dependent on other people, that want to build cool things that they can show to other people and their teams and sort of drive that change internally.
This is Thomas. He and his co-founder Daniel previously worked as consultants in the data space before founding Less. Their experiences and frustrations in this role inspired them to create an analytics product for people like themselves. And that led to the birth of Less in 2022. The name Less embodies their goal to stripping away complexities to build a product that focuses on the end goal and takes care of the technical aspects behind the scenes. And their mission? Set doers free to do what they do best, roll up their sleeves and solve problems. And this inspired me, and hence I invited Thomas to my podcast. We explore what after decades of development is still broken in the business analytics solution space. Thomas shares his lessons learned from steering Less on his journey as a customer-funded startup. He shares how he's got early traction with paying customers and how he's creating a culture of analogical thinking to solve problems in creative ways. Last but not least, he'll inspire you with his fresh perspective on creating a compelling narrative that sells. And by listening to this podcast, you will learn four things. Firstly, where he finds inspiration for taking storytelling of his business to the next level. Secondly, what he has done differently from the start to get traction and stay in control as the business grows. Thirdly, how he ensures everyone in the company understands what's important and does the right things right to create fans from the start. And lastly, why he embraces being customer funded rather than just bootstrapped. Well, hi, Thomas. Thank you for making your time available today and being the guest on the podcast.
Hi, Ton. Thanks a lot. I appreciate the invite.
Yeah, I mean, that was we were connected to each other by another contact that I have, David Prentzel, who is the CEO of a company or a studio called GW Studios, Sweden. And he was bragging about the website on LinkedIn, the website of Less. And I had to look into that. I loved what I saw. So in my definition, it's remarkable what you've done there. And yeah, that got me intrigued in what you're doing. Because it's B2B software.
It is. We were, I think, very fortunate to be able to work with David. They're extremely talented. And to be fair, they were the ones that designed the website. We were just the implementation. So all credit goes to him and his team.
Yeah. Well, it proves again what you can do with almost like a Would you, I would maybe even call it a dull area, like finance. I mean, I was in finance and ERP all the time, but this is about data and data infrastructures, and to make that stand out in a way that, you can actually, you grab the attention. So well done. Before we start talking about your company, Lest, the company that you founded in September 22, what would you say drives you as an entrepreneur? What do you get energy from?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think what drives me personally is the product. That was why we got into building Less or starting out Less. Both Daniel, my co-founder, and I, we worked as consultants in the data space. And we were very driven by creating something for people like us. And that sort of continues to be the driving force now in a little bit of a different way. But interacting with clients that are using the product that you've built in the way that you hope that they would interact with it, I think that's extremely rewarding for me, at least. Makes support very fun. So I think for me, it still continues to be very product-led, my motivations.
There's nothing wrong with that. But I think you mentioned a very important word. You know, you build something and you design something the way you have a certain vision in mind, and the reward comes from seeing people get the value by using it the way you've meant it to be. And I think that is an art, especially in the space where you are in, because it's such a difficult space. So yeah, interesting. So you started your business about 2 years ago. It's July right now. What was the problem that you saw that was screaming for a solution like you developed in the meantime?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we always, in these conversations, like to sort of take a step back, because both Dane and I, we don't come from any sort of technical educational backgrounds. We studied both at business school. Daniel's a little bit more technical than I am, or quite a bit more technical, but we don't bring any sort of heavy data science or computer science background with us. And we've worked as consultants on a lot of different projects. And I think what kind of stood out and frustrated us was that you always ended up spending a lot of time on these sort of technical infrastructural roadblocks instead of diving into the data, finding insights, and automating processes, what we thought was fun. And that's what sort of built up to what eventually became Less, where you can have a platform that's, at least we aspire to be, extremely easy to use and fun to use, importantly, that doesn't compromise something that's robust and powerful. So where that infrastructure is sort of built directly into the platform, those two things in tandem is what sort of led us to build our product. We were never those technical people that enjoyed setting up databases or infrastructure or getting emails with CSV files from marketing teams. That was not really, those infrastructural roadblocks were very frustrating. And we decided that let's try and build something that's super easy to use with those technical components built into it.
Nice. Yeah, I mean, I think that sort of connects to the name that you chosen for the company. But what is the story about Less? How did you come up with the name?
Well, we came up with the name by looping over, I think, 100 candidates and finding out if we could pay for the domain. And Less turned out to be a good name that also had an affordable domain name. But I think in more, you know, holistically, what's been going on in the analytics space for the past, say, 20 years, we'll make it a quick overview, is, as you know, a lot of ERP system in the sort of early zeros and 2000s, moving into this modern data stack with a very fragmented space, a lot of different tools, very technical, that solved a fraction of a process of becoming data-driven or working smarter with data. And to us, it became, we at least believe that that's not the route that a lot of people has to take. Setting up 5-6 different systems to work smarter with data almost kind of contradicts the point of working smarter with data, because it becomes so complex that only a few people can do it. So Less became the embodiment of that, where it sort of strip away those complexities and build a product that focuses on the core and takes care of the rest behind the scene.
Love the storytelling here. And it's so true, because it's always about more, more, more. And that's, I mean, marketing is suffering from that. The marketing stack, sales is suffering from that. I mean, I think any industry that you go into, every category of software is getting more and more fragmented, and it's taking away indeed from the purpose. Before we started the call, you mentioned a point also about at times it feels like solving a problem by inventing a new role, like the data scientist, instead of actually fixing the underlying issue. Explain it.
Well, I think, you know, for many years, I think Excel was invented in the mid 80s or something like that. That's been the sort of go-to tooling for analytics. And at some point, the world of data just became too complex. Companies started to adopt too many software solutions, all of which created data. It got unmanageable for a product like Excel. I mean, people still use it. They just do it in a very manual way. And instead of fixing that tooling problem with a spreadsheet solution like Excel, there was this invention of a new role, the role of a data scientist, which now is sort of morphed into data engineers, data analysts, all kinds of sort of fancy words. And there's nothing wrong with what those people do. They're more technical than I hope to be one day. But I think for a lot of people, at least, setting up those kind of teams solves a problem in a wrong way. Instead of focusing on the problem of let's build a tool that's easy enough to make modern analytics available to more people, we say let's outsource it to the people that know how to use the tools that are available. I think that distinction is, or friction is, kind of what led us to at least start testing out if we could do something with software that could solve those problems.
Yeah, it's a nice bar to raise, so to say. And I completely agree with you, because it's not only that these people, of course, and they're doing a great job, no doubt about that, but it also creates dependency in companies. And with the pace of change that companies are going through these days, yeah, that becomes a bottleneck very, very easily.
Yeah, and I think even more important to distinguish between the maturity of the company you're working for. Right? If you're working at Spotify, you should have a team of hundreds of data engineers, data scientists, etc., because you're just at a scale with so many events and so much complexity that you need dedicated, specialized, super technical people to deal with it. Yeah. But there's a lot of companies that are not Spotify. And for us, that sort of mid-market segment has been where we've been operating so far. And I think that's perhaps what we want to bring to the table, that there is a way that works for very large venture-backed companies or public companies that are very mature and have mature needs. But there are alternative paths for those that don't want the additional complexity.
Yeah, completely
agree. Which I think is an important nuance to the discussion about solving a problem with inventing a new role.
Yeah. So it's also a lot about the decisions you took about, yeah, who you're for and who you're not for. A lot of companies, of course, they think, okay, we build this product, the analytics infrastructure, analytics products, and we sell that to, yeah, the high end of the market because that's where the money is. You decided to go a different route. How has it paid off for you so far to make that choice, the deliberate choice about who you're for and who you're not for?
I think it's a very difficult, it's not a difficult choice, but it's difficult to maintain that, right? It's tough to say no to RFPs from larger clients, for example. That's not always fun because you understand there's more money at these accounts that take a longer time. But I think for us, it's especially because we're a bootstrap company. I don't like the word bootstrapped, customer funded, I think is more appropriate, but we need to keep that focus in who we're trying to serve, especially as a data company, especially as a bootstrap company. So I think those are two of the reasons that we're choosing to do it as we do.
I like the distinction that you made there, customer funded, because that's exactly also how I think about it. Bootstrap is the wrong name for the beast. The companies that are taking that route, yeah, they fundamentally build better companies than the ones that choose from the past, at least the way I think about it, that choose from the beginning to go the VC route. And don't take me wrong, for some type of products, you know, the deep tech and some other categories in that space, it's almost impossible to fund it yourself. But for a lot of B2B software companies, it is perfectly possible to go the customer-funded route and to build something that, yeah, that customers are happily prepared to pay premium for. So nice one. That gives you choice, gives you options. Talk about that a little bit later.
Yeah.
So 2 years ago, that was okay. It was still COVID. It was also already, I think, in that phase where all these generative AI tools came to market. There's so much the industry of data analytics and data infrastructures is also pretty mature. So what has been an early decision that appeared to be really important in terms of what you betted on from the start to get it to where it is today?
I think we betted on the role of the person that has some kind of tacit knowledge about the problems that they're trying to solve. We bet on taking time to evaluate how is this going to evolve and not jumping the bandwagon too early on. And the first point that I made, I think, is more important, that in our opinion, in the world of sort of data analytics at SME companies, the complexity lies in the fact that you have a business person that has a lot of knowledge about the problems they're facing, the data they're generating, the answers they would like. And you have a technical team, which is supposed to support that business person. And that distinction creates friction, which we try to solve by bringing a software product to the business person so that he or she can answer those questions to himself or herself. So we've been continuously focusing on servicing that user, which I think is important because in the sort of realm of AI and what we've seen with LLM models recently, they're extremely good at creating code. But if you don't understand code, you can't pinpoint the errors. You don't know what you're getting. You can copy paste stuff, but you're at a risk of getting wrong answers to some very fundamental questions. And I think that risk hasn't been solved yet. And for that reason, we're still sort of evaluating the trends in that we see happening. Because the people that we service, they're not coders. So we got to be careful in automating coding that they can't validate and see what's going on under the hood. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes total sense, of course. It's a different role that you focus on and it gives different challenges to solve. So what has been the toughest decision that you had to make in that area, or the hardest nut to crack almost?
I think the hardest thing for us is and continues to be go-to-market and sales. I think for a horizontal data product like us, I think that's the toughest piece of the puzzle that we have to solve for. And we can dive into a couple, or at least one of the frameworks or methods that we've been working with later on, if it makes sense. But I think the fundamental issue is that with a data company like ours or data product like ours, you can analyze any data. It can be sales data, marketing data, ops data, finance data, whatever. That makes it very difficult to focus and narrow down on where you create the most value. And I think that continues to be the biggest problem to solve for a company like us, and not how we're going to implement AI, at least not yet. We're still evaluating that part.
Exactly. You got this typical dilemma of almost a Swiss Army knife, right? You build a product that is so powerful, so flexible that you can do anything with it, but nobody's Googling anything. So they have very special use cases that you need to solve for. And so how have you gone about it? You talked about frameworks already. What has worked for you to hit the right nerve, as I talk in my book, is chapter number 10?
I think for us, we've been focusing more on the persona than on the sector or industry. So we've been focusing on finding, we call them doers in the work that we've done with David and his team at GW, but people that are sort of curious by nature, that are frustrated with being dependent on other people, that want to build cool things that they can show to other people in their teams and sort of drive that change internally.
Let me make a small interruption here. Thomas just made a critical remark that underpins their success. They realize a solution has a specific appeal with people who see challenges earlier than others, who want to solve things when they see the opportunity, value being independent, and aspire making a meaningful difference internally. They've realized that they've got an instant click with people who meet those criteria. Conversations go like yes and instead of yes but. And that's a trait remarkable SaaS companies master. They realize that they cannot please everyone, and that's okay. This way, they can focus on the essence, create new value possibilities, establish strong product market fit in the shortest amount of time, and bring that to market in a way that's different, not just better. That's noticed and creates desire and momentum. You can master these traits as well. And the first step? Simply read my book. I've made the electronic version available for free. Just visit theremarkableeffect.com to grab your copy, and inspiration will spark within 10 minutes. Back to the interview.
So that's on the sort of softer value side of who we're trying to service. And of course, you got to map that up to, okay, but where do we find in organizations people that have touch points with multiple domains internally in the organization? Because that's when that Swiss Army knife becomes relevant, right? So for us currently, we're primarily working with people in finance operations, because by definition, those people are tasked with analyzing the performance of their business, which draws information from multiple domains. So they need that kind of Swiss Army knife tooling. And I think what we're seeing is that they fulfill oftentimes that persona of being very curious, very driven to sort of making changes in the way that their company operates.
Well said. I mean, you're following the perfect route there, because a lot of companies stop by it's a finance person, or it's they stick to the demographics and maybe the firmographics, but don't go into what's underneath there. What kind of person is that? And it doesn't mean, well, I'm not talking about here, but they drink red wine and they have a BMW as a car. But what you're saying here is like they're curious, frustrated with this. They are doers. I mean, the moment you speak to them like that, that's how they recognize themselves. Yeah, hey, that's me. You get me. And that is a very important part of the whole mix. And the moment you start to look into that with those type of dynamics and psychographic flavors, I got an essay on that where I'm talking about creating the perfect or your favorite segmentation cocktail, because it's all these little ingredients that you throw in that make up for the people. Well, when people see it, it's like, hey, I want that. Or this is me. That's where you will start to attract these right type of people. And there will be plenty of people that where you're not for, who are not curious. They want to have it all set, who want to delegate things. And that's fine, because that's another category of companies, and they will never become your fans. But this is good. Also with those special type of characteristics, you'll find the problems that they wake up for at night. You know, it's the things that are super valuable and critical to them, where you, with your solution and the set of capabilities that you created, can actually exceed expectations. Because that's also an important part. Then you create something that becomes critical to them and mission critical to the organization rather than nice to have. Perfect.
Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's that. I mean, of course, it's quite short. And I mean, it's impressive what you've built already. I mean, you got your first customers in a relatively short time. What have you learned from getting into market?
I think what I learned, or what we learned, equally as much to Daniel's sort of credit as mine, is the value of network. I think for a bootstrap company initially, you must validate commercially that you're onto something quite fast, because otherwise it's not going to fly. And I think in that domain, we at least early on validated that if you've got a network that you can draw on for getting in front of the right people, that's tremendously valuable. That was the first 10 clients of us were directly coming from sort of our network of working in the data analytics space previously. I think that's the major learning that we had in the first period of starting to sell our software.
Yeah. So the value of network, anything else?
I mean, as a bootstrap company, I think there's a couple of things that you must be prepared to get into, or at least that we have learned that we had to sort of be prepared to accept. And I think one of them is that you're accepting a balance where you do things slower, but you got more control. And the fact that you do things slower in some cases can, at least to us, have been quite valuable, that you got to be extremely careful of where do you dedicate your resources, which in this case is time and money, which is probably is for a lot of people. But we got to be extra careful because we don't have a lot of either of those. So we got to be strict in where do we dedicate our resources. And I think the second part is that you got to be prepared to be a generalist, right? You got to enjoy jumping from domain to domain. If you don't enjoy sitting in and learning about inside content marketing and how HubSpot did that, and jumping to best way to do budgeting and forecasting, then you're gonna run into a problem at some point, because you're not gonna have the resources to hire your way out of every problem that you sort of get to. So I think those two, enjoy that things will be slower and that in some cases it's a positive thing. And two, accept that you will be learning a lot of new things from across a number of different domains.
Yeah, exactly. So true, the generalist aspect. And now the specialist will come later when you maybe are at 50 or 100 people, but not at the stage where you are right now.
And I think that's one of the things that I at least wanted to bring up today, that the specialists are definitely powerful, but I think that sort of generalist role is equally powerful. We talked earlier before we started recording about this book called Range by a guy called David Epstein, I think. He talks about this kind of analogical thinking where you're able to draw knowledge from different kind of domains when you got to solve a problem, and speaks about a couple of cases where they prove that the resources they get to significantly increase when they're able to see parallel structures from problem A to the problem that you're facing today. So I think there's value in itself from having that kind of generalist approach to the way that you are operating.
The question is whether it's generalist approach. At the end, it's the art of connecting dots, you know, and being able to step back.
Definitely, it is. Yeah.
Yeah, you can be a specialist, but you can still have that capability, I would say. And it's maybe even setting yourself to the point to be able to step back and see, hey, wait a minute, what is the big picture here?
100%. And I think you just got to promote that you have to spend time and resources in jumping from those different domains, because you got to accept the fact that you will be, in my case, learning to code front end, doing budgeting, learning about marketing, sales, conducting the right demos, setting up support and structures for the new customers that we onboard. And accepting and enjoying that that's what you're going to do, I think, helps getting that sort of mindset that you spoke about. And you're right that it doesn't have to be overly complex. It's just about sort of connecting dots from different domains. But I think promoting a culture and a workspace where you embrace that thinking is important.
Yeah. You touched upon another important point, that cultural side. And what I read between the lines here is that you give people the freedom to figure it out themselves and to own a particular outcome and be creative in that space. Is that true?
Yeah, I think it's definitely true. I think we solve for objective and not the way to get there. That's also one of the values that we sort of like to say, that there's direction over management, right? We don't want to micromanage the people that we work with, because we trust that they're much better at solving the problem than we are. That's why we want to work with them. But we got a direction that we want to go to, in our case, making it easy to do analytics for more people. I think that's the sort of guiding principle in our case.
Yeah. But yeah, you listened to the podcast that I had with Christian Owens, who was talking about his two holistic principles. Your company, of course, it has a certain size and it has certain ambitions. How do you ensure that people, what are maybe one or two of those questions that your people can always work with to figure out, okay, this is the right decision to make here? Have you got those type of?
I think we got two things that we are always trying to balance. And we spoke a little bit about them, I think, perhaps indirectly earlier. But our product has to be the easiest and most intuitive analytics product to use. And it has to be as robust, as powerful, as flexible as whatever people could code for themselves. If we balance those two things with the way that we build things, and it doesn't matter if it's a new feature or a new way to do a documentation site for onboarding new users, with those two things in mind, ease of use and flexibility, then we're building towards the right ambition. So if you can answer yes to those two questions, you are on the right track.
Yeah, exactly. Again, you're not talking about how you do things. You give someone sort of an outcome that is a constantly moving target. And that keeps people also on their toes in terms of, okay, what is the best at the moment? What is the most user-friendly? Is there anything happening in other industries that we can actually leverage to our advantage here?
Definitely. Yeah, for sure.
Fascinating. By the way, making something easy and flexible is almost the opposite of each other. And so kudos if you pulled it off. But so far from what I've seen on the website, you're doing a fantastic job there.
I think we're speaking about relative easiness, right?
Yeah.
Always relative easiness. We cannot, that's the whole point of having that kind of Swiss Army analytics tool. We're built for things you can't just automate. So of course it would be easier if you could just press a button and get all the analytics, all the automations that you wanted. But you can't, because that's not really possible for the people that we work with, because everything is custom in their world. So relative easiness should be the guiding principle. Perhaps that's a good addition to the docs that we do internally.
Yeah. One thing I want to kind of hone in a little bit, that also came from discussing a couple of things before. I would admit, you said we come from a business background. That is already maybe a link to understanding the topic I want to address here. But at the end, you're in the data space, the data infrastructure, the data analytics, which is about data. It's about numbers. It's about facts and kind of pulling unstructured things and doing something with it. And then you said you've got this sort of a weak spot for storytelling. So what have you learned there? And how do the two go together, and how do you apply that in the business and the product that you're using?
Well, I think exactly for the points that you're mentioning, right? Being in analytics and infrastructure and all these things are not very exciting to a lot of people out there. And the funny thing is that the underlying themes that they try to solve for, I think, are pretty interesting and exciting to a lot of people. And everybody wants to be the person that has answers. Everyone I know wants to be that person. Everybody wants to be that individual who builds something new, cool, that saves 50 hours per month for their team. Like, and I think that's what data analytics and infrastructure and tooling and all these kind of things, that's what they enable. But at the market that we're servicing, if you go speak about those things, you become exactly what they don't like anymore, right? You're just doing the same as everybody else. So I think for us, it's been quite a journey, because we started out talking about product as well, by working with people who are much more talented than we are, been able to sort of shift the mindset and go from, here's this tool that can read in 100 million rows that you won't even see that is happening, to, hey, be the person with answers. That kind of shift in mentality has been quite helpful for us.
It is. And you're hitting the nail on the head there. It's not about the output, it's about the outcome. And what that does to people, I mean, it will make them being seen in the company. It will make them help other people, which is far more in terms of what these people are about themselves. You know, the doer, you said, and the people that are curious, that want to help others grow, make that impact. That's what they are actually buying from you. And like how that's being delivered, it's a completely different story. So fascinating. You also said something about, you made a connection to reading books, fictional books, non-fictional books.
Yeah, I think it's nothing against non-fictional books, but I think we talked a little bit earlier about the fact that at least for someone like me, I'm very pragmatic, love numbers, data, rows and columns, that sort of stuff. And one of the things that's been difficult for me is to kind of understand that power of the storytelling that we just touched on. And where I've come to found inspiration is from some of the fiction books that I read instead. I think that sort of helped balance the scale for me, because non-fictional books with data and studies and all those things, they're great and they expand your horizon quite a bit, but that sort of building up of a hero persona, that curious person, the person with the answers, the person that changes the team dynamics, there I've at least been able to draw more on the way that fictional books are structured and that sort of continuous storytelling throughout those than I have from some of the nonfiction work out there.
Yeah. I mean, when you were talking about it, it was like, I never thought about it like that, but you're completely right. And it's also, it's funny enough, I wrote my book, and of course it's a non-fictional book, but I wrote it in a fictional way. And that's also the compliments I get from the people that are reading The Remarkable Effect. It's Actually, yesterday, one of the people in my mastermind, Rami Darwish, the CEO of Aero Labs, he said, you know, that book that I read it in 3 to 4 days. I just crashed through it. Mm-hmm. And I was getting back to it and saying, hey, what are they going to do after right now? What are they going to, I mean, are they going to the airport? What's going to happen there? And of course, it's the way you tell the story that matters most. And that is what people remember. Even for things that are dull and can be very dry to explain, you know, it's
yeah, for sure. And I think it's also about understanding sort of some of your own shortcomings and where you could get better, right? Because exactly. I'd always ask people for show me the numbers kind of thing, right? Here's an argument for why we should do X, which in this case could be, let's improve our storytelling on the website. Thomas a few years ago would have asked, but like, show me why I should do that and not just tell them about the great product that we had. And I think understanding those shortcomings that you're exposed to yourself means that it's not about whether it's fiction over nonfiction. That's not the thing. It's more about, you got to understand the value of being able, in my case, to tell that story in a exciting way that builds up to some kind of aha moment, which comes from me, not from the fact that fiction or nonfiction books are bad. That's not sort of the argument that I'm making, right?
No, exactly. It's about getting the point across in a simple way. And sometimes an analogy and a story helps 10 times, 100 times better than that number. You know, what does it say that you are, that your growth margin is 65?
Yeah, not a lot. Well, it says something, but it's not that interesting.
Exactly. True. But the moment you can tell the story around it, that that brings it alive and that gets people to act. And I think that's the most important part. Looking at the time, I mean, I've already kind of highlighted the book that I wrote, the Remarkable Effect, and the fact that it's about what defines those companies that we start talking about and keep talking about. What I'm always interested in is to understand from, on a day-to-day basis, what are you doing to ensure that what's coming out of the factory is what people talk about? Do you have special ingredients for that, or checklists, or...
I think I wish we had the special ingredients all the time. I think we're trying to work in a structured way where we use these. I found inspiration in a book called The Checklist Manifesto, which is about, it's written by this doctor who were part of rolling out these checklists in surgery for the WHO, I think. And it sounds extremely simple, but it's sort of like this instrument of protection against failure, in a sense, right? It's not going to change the world, but it's protecting you against some kind of failure in the process that you're doing. Mm-hmm. So in, I think there's an example in the book by some value investor kind of person who, as part of their checklist in evaluating whether or not they should invest in the stock or company, all the team members have to recognize that they've read the footnotes and the financial statements of that company. Like, super basic stuff, right? But that's kind of the beauty of it. And to us, we've tried to take that same kind of mentality into fields where it made sense for us. One example is onboarding of clients, where to us, it's extremely important that we, and it is probably for most software companies, but we got to activate the user in becoming that person that we've touched on a few times within an onboarding period. So there's a couple of things like scheduling 3 to 4 follow-up sessions during the first 30 days to make sure that we get it done, right? Super basic stuff, but if you don't do it, turns out a lot of the times it doesn't go the way you hoped. Second thing that we do on the onboarding things, sit in on a meeting, like we're sitting on a meeting now, with that user when they build out their first model, right? Push them to that aha moment so they can see that they can become that person that we talked about. And those kind of checklist things, they sound deadly boring, and sometimes they actually are, but I think it helps codify knowledge that you've seen work in other instances.
Yeah. What I like about this is that it's not about like the visual things, but it's more about the outcome, particularly that last example of sitting on a call and literally staying there until they get the aha moment that will help them become that person. And that is about the transformation they all want, and that also that you want.
It is, and it comes from the reverse case, right? It comes from a failure, as you mentioned. It's the these checklists, they work for us because they're protection against failure. So they come from an outcome where we do 30-day free trials. Within those 30-day free trials, a failure would be that we don't find that user so that we can help upskill and become the person we talked about. Okay, so let's work back from that. In 30 days, what might lead to the fact that they don't? Well, if they don't understand how they can build models in less relatively easy, they're not going to get there. Two, if we don't keep continuously engaging over that 30-day period so we show the value, they're not going to recommend that we purchase the software from us. So I think it's always about working backwards from a scenario that you wouldn't like to happen.
Yeah, exactly. True. Often we don't want to think about it. And often we also think, okay, the deal is a deal. They are going to pay. The moment we deliver it and it's live, we're done. And you're not. Because what you want is a customer that becomes a fan, that actually talks, well, buys more from you, buys more often, and possibly even more important, brings their friends. That is a go-to-market machine that you can't fund against, talking about customer funded. Last question. From your experience right now running the company and possibly from before, what would be a do and what would be a don't that you'd like to share with other SaaS CEOs, tech entrepreneurs?
That's a tough question, I think. And I think important to mention that we're still so early in our journey, right? 2 years into it, at this stage, that there's a slight degree of sort of imposter syndrome when being asked these questions, that I'm not sure that our company yet justifies me giving advice to a lot of other people out there. I think I can only reflect on what's been helpful for us.
Yeah.
And for us, it was very helpful that we started early on getting commercial validation that we were onto something. We sold a product that barely worked, right? Parts of it that we built since then weren't there at the time, right? So we did it manually. But we validated that if we could solve for some of those problems that we've talked about, right? Help those curious people find answers. If we could solve for those in a little bit more manual way, people were really willing to pay. So early on, commercialize or validate that your idea has some kind of commercial legs. And I think the don't would be that, I mean, we're a bootstrap company, and I'd advise people at least to not necessarily follow the path of other companies out there just because other people are doing it. It's been quite rewarding for us to have that optionality and grow slower than what some companies do, but at a pace where we're happy and we're growing a healthy business that has a sort of a profitable nature to it. I think those two would be my recommendations. Validate commercially and don't necessarily follow in the footsteps of all the other companies out there.
Well said. I think these are nice words to close it off. Where can people find out more to go? Find out more about Less, or to say hi to you.
They can go to less.tech, which is our website, or they can reach out to me on LinkedIn or via email or anything like that.
Thank you very much. What's your email address?
Thomas@less.tech.
Okay. How simple can it be? Thank you very much, Thomas. The remarkable example, like I said in the beginning of the call, of what can be done in the B2B software space, software that is by nature maybe not as exciting, and making it the opposite. I'll follow you on the rest of your journey. So likely we'll have another call in about 2 years when you're doubled the number of years. Thanks for being open and sharing the wisdom.
I'd love to come back. Thanks a lot, Tom, for inviting me. This was a great pleasure.
Same for me. Thanks. And this ends my conversation with Thomas, and I hope you enjoyed it. And if so, please leave a review on iTunes. And if it inspired you, please share it with another tech entrepreneur on a mission that you have in your network. Other than that, thank you for tuning into this podcast. I had the honor to speak to Thomas Wulfs Wilhelmsen, co-founder and CEO of Less. As said, the goal that I have in this podcast is twofold. Firstly, to inspire new forms of value creation by sharing compelling ideas and stories about the potential we can unlock when technology and people blend in the right way. And secondly, share experiences from tech entrepreneurs like you about what is required to create a remarkable software business and how to overcome the roadblocks to do so. Before I close, I have two more comments to make. If you know other tech entrepreneurs on a mission that have a story worth sharing, please send me an email at ton.dobby@valueinspiration.com. Building the momentum all starts with revealing the ideas, and that starts with you. And if you want to know more about my book, or you're interested in joining the remarkable effect tribe, please visit my website at www.valueinspiration.com. Thanks for tuning in. And you could do me a big favor by rating the podcast on iTunes or provide me with your feedback directly. I'll see you shortly on a new episode.